the real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
I'm Tom Terrific, greatest hero ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
That's me, Tom Terrific, right here in the bunker. Right here in the bunker on a cool, cool day here in north central Indiana. Rained all night again. We're getting that last bit of rain before it starts snowing. Hey, this is October the 31st. This is the very, very last chance you get to fulfill your fantasies in this month, this day of this year. And you'll never get another chance at this date. We're at P.O. Box 401. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your massive amounts of donations, yeah, to keep Tommy working here and keep the equipment working and keep the few bills in the bunker here going, paid for, and all that kind of stuff. So, and then go up to resist.com and get an education. Don't let them make you dumb forever. And go to resist.com and get undumb. Yeah, it's better than going to Harvard, I'll tell you that. Yeah. So anyhow, what are we going to do today? Whoa. I sent out a morning report, a wake-up MP3 this morning, entitled Who's Putin of Russia? And this was recorded off RT Television, which is one of the only ones that I really have any kind of confidence in at all anymore. Not that I have total confidence in anything. But it's pretty good. It's got about four or five people on there discussing the pros and cons, mostly pro, of Putin. And so anyhow, sometimes I'm very cynical about world leaders, of course, but on the other hand, sometimes we have to put it all out there and see how the mop flops. So anyhow, I hope you enjoy that for your Friday wake-up call. This is Ladies' Day in the Bunker, She-Wolf's Day in the Bunker, and we'll have a little song for the She-Wolves pretty soon. I don't know whether they always just like these lovey-dovey songs, or maybe sometimes they like the kick-ass songs, so they'll have to let me know. Well, here's a song I think all you gals would like and understand. Okay?
Hello, my friend! Hi.
Well, Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. He was a beautiful guy.
He was a long-legged guitar picker with a wicked wandering eye. But he was her man nearly all of the time.
Well, Johnny, he packed up to leave her, but he promised he'd be back.
He said he had a little picking to do a little farther down the track.
He said, I'm your man, I wouldn't do you wrong. Frankie curled up on a sofa, thinking about her man.
Far away the couples were dancing to the music of his band.
He was Frankie's man. He wasn't doing her wrong, yet. Well, he sang every song to the redhead. She smiled back at him.
Then he came and sat at her table where the lights were low and dim.
What Frankie didn't know wouldn't hurt her none. Then the redhead jumped up and slapped him a time or two.
She said, I'm Frankie's sister, and I was checking up on you. If you're her man, you better treat her right. Well, the moral of this story is be good but carry a stick. Sometimes it looks like a guitar picker just can't tell what to pick. He was Frankie's man, and he still ain't done her.
There you go. That goes out to the she-wolves out there. They know how that goes. Frankie and Johnny, man. Gotta watch it, guys. Now, I know a lot of you guys out there like beer, but they're screwing with you. They're screwing with you, thinking you're getting micro beer, the real good beer, and it's the big boys screwing you. Here's Jim Hightower to talk about it. Yeah, man. That ain't right.
It's bad enough that the Goliaths of big beer are consuming each other in a new round of mega mergers, meaning fewer choices and higher prices for consumers. But the really bad news is that they're also going after the one bright spot on tap in bars all across the country, craft beers. These are not merely beers, but jewels of the brewer's art, yeasty, hoppy, and malty, local delights with unique, deep flavors that put the fizzy yellow suds of Budweiser, Miller, and Coors to shame. And, not surprisingly, while the sales of big beer's fizz are declining, the craft brewers are up by 17% last year alone, and the number of craft brewers has nearly doubled since 2010. The giants have noticed, and they're responding. By making better beer? Don't be silly. Instead, they're trying to co-opt the good name of local beer makers and dupe consumers by pretending that the likes of Bud and Miller are craft brewers, too. How? Two ways. First, they've created false fronts like Blue Moon Brewing Company, 10th and Blake, and Green Valley Brewery, pretending to be upstart independents. You won't see the name of Miller Coors or Anheuser-Busch on the labels, but those are the macro brewers that own and make such ersatz macro brews as Blue Moon, Killian's, and Shock Top. Second, the deep-pocketed beer behemoths are simply buying up small craft brewers, including Goose Island by Anheuser-Busch and Leinenkugel by Miller Coors. Again, they're co-opting the imagery of cool independence, but shh, it's the same old big beer hiding behind the small guy's labels. This is Jim Hightower saying, when all else fails, the giants get thuggish, using their marketing muscle and political punch to knock the craft beers out of bars and off the shelves. But the independents are scrappy, and it's up to us quaffers of real beer to stand up and drink with them.
I don't drink much beer, but in fact, less as I get older. But that's really revealing because I was drinking a little bit of Killian and didn't taste too bad. But now I see that's put out by one of the big boys, and I see that Blue Moon and like that. Well, and then I would drink Corona once in a while, which is actually made in Mexico, but it's probably a better beer than these big companies. But I don't know. Probably Corona's been bought up by these big boys. So I guess I'll go down here. We got a place here in town where I can get some beer that's made right here in town. And tastes good. A little expensive. A little more expensive, but that is when I got time to have a beer. Well, there's a young man by the name of Isaiah Marin. He looks white, but I'm not sure about that. His other features are a little funny, but a religious zealot. Here we go again. Christ Insanity in Oklahoma. Nearly beheaded an acquaintance in a brutal slaying after watching Christian videos, police said. Isaiah Marin was playing cards Wednesday afternoon with his brother and the victim, 19-year-old Jacob Crockett, at an apartment in Stillwater, Oklahoma, where there's more churches than you can count. Police said that the 21-year-old Marin was watching online videos related to his Christian beliefs and the book of Matthew, before he picked up a sword and began swinging it around. Whoa. His brother told him to be careful, and then he told the police that Marin stabbed the Crockett in the chest. Marin's brother said the suspect had argued with Crockett in the past because the victim and his brother Jesse were practicing witchcraft, and Isaiah had strong Christian beliefs. So Samuel Marin fled from the apartment, police said, and his brother ran after him and promised to explain why he had killed the teen in letters from jail. Police said Isaiah Marin called 911 and confessed that he had murdered someone before rambling about magic and sacrifices. Quote, "I hacked them to death with a machete," unquote, Marin told dispatchers. Police found Marin walking along the state highway covered in blood and carrying a long knife. Marin said he had fantasized about killing four or five people, including Crockett, police said. Investigators said that Crockett, who was the son of an Oklahoma Highway Patrol officer, had been nearly decapitated in the attack. Jesse Crockett, the victim's brother, said Marin was a heavy drug user and a religious zealot. Well, I'll tell you, put those two together and you got bad news. Police said the case had no religious implications and was not related to recent beheadings by Islamic extremists, including an attack on a Muslim convert in an Oklahoma food plant. Wait a minute, no religious implications? The guy was rambling on about Matthew and the Bible and all that kind of stuff. What do you mean? Marin, a student at Northern Oklahoma College who intended to transfer to Oklahoma State University, was charged with first-degree murder and remains held without bail. Wow. That's something else. Something else, baby.
It's beautiful.
Killed in a horrific act in Stillwater.
The victim's head almost severed from his body. And new tonight, we can tell you that police are now looking into the suspect's religious ties as a possible motivation in this. News Channel 4's Ed Doney joins us live from our mobile newsroom in Stillwater. And Ed, the crime, which is ghastly, may have stemmed from an obsession with witchcraft and Christianity, we're hearing.
Yeah, Kevin, court records show that the suspect thought that the victim may have been practicing witchcraft. Police say that the motive is not official, but said the suspect admitted to them to fantasizing about killing four or even five other people.
Less than 24 hours after police found the nearly decapitated body of 19-year-old Jacob Crockett at this Stillwater apartment on South Oakdale, an acquaintance is charged with first-degree murder. 21-year-old Isaiah Zohar Marin allegedly used the victim's sword to murder Crockett Wednesday afternoon.
His head was almost entirely severed from his body, and there are substantial wounds to the body consistent with the weapon we recovered.
Stillwater Police Captain Randy Dickerson says Marin confessed to the crime and was arrested walking along Highway 51 in western Stillwater with bloody clothes and carrying the weapon. An arrest affidavit says Marin soon began, quote, rambling about sacrificing and magic. Police say the motive is still unclear, but said Marin admitted to fantasizing about killing four or five people. They say as of now, the case is not related to other recent beheadings by Islamic extremists.
If you're asking about the past beheadings with the ISIS and any relation there, we have found none of that.
However, in the affidavit, the victim's brother called Marin a heavy drug user and religious zealot. And Marin's own brother told police the victim and suspect had disagreements because Jacob and his brother were, quote, practicing witchcraft and Isaiah had strong Christian beliefs.
Now, neighbors at Crockett's and Marin's residences had no comment for us today. Police say Crockett actually attended Northern Oklahoma College and had plans to transfer here to Stillwater at Oklahoma State University. Now, his father, Crockett's father, is an OHP trooper, but police say there is absolutely no connection to that occupation and this alleged murder. Marin posted on Facebook in August, quote, "I want to have a job." His preliminary hearing conference is set for December the 1st. Reporting live in Stillwater, I'm Ed Doney, News Channel 4.
Always amazed at how cleverly these Republicrats play around a little on the edges of the racist thing. Just enough that they step over the line a little bit, but they jump right back. And it always happens around election time, where they're sending out almost code words. I am really a racist white man. Listen to Bill O'Reilly.
Looking out for their best interest. The facts are this, that Democrats continue to take the black vote for granted. Republicans continue to ignore that vote. So if you're African American, what do you do? The reality is that neither party is truly interested, I believe, in the economic opportunity and the social mobility of African American voters. So you can spin all day long that only the Democrats are guilty of that. The Republicans aren't doing much better at all.
All right. So you say that the Republican Party is apathetic. They don't really care.
Don't care.
Okay.
Maybe Rand Paul.
Maybe. That might be true. I mean, I think they're more intimidated, though, than uncaring. I think they're
intimidated by what?
I think they're afraid. I think they're afraid of black people.
Are black folks scary? I mean, scary?
No. The white Republican power structure is afraid of black Americans. They don't know how to treat them. They don't know how to speak to them. They don't know anything about the culture. And they don't want to be called a racist bigot, so they stay away.
But why does that make you scared as opposed to being interested in understanding, embracing?
Because they feel it's not worth the trouble, the few votes they might siphon off, to get involved with it. That's how they feel. I know that for a fact. Now, what do you think? You've been critical of the Democratic Party and of President Obama. Mm-hmm. What do you want? What should President Obama be doing for African Americans that he's not doing?
The facts you laid out earlier in this regard are true. African Americans, the data will indicate, when this president's out of office, have lost ground in every single leading economic indicator category. Whenever one who happens to be black says that, all of a sudden we're hating on the president, when in fact these are what the numbers are going to indicate.
Those are the numbers. But whites have lost ground too. Everybody's lost ground.
But the problem with your analysis earlier, though, Bill, is that it's not about whether black folk are doing better today than we were 200 years ago. The question is whether or not we're doing better today versus white folk today, and that's where you missed the argument on the white privilege issue. White privilege still exists today because even if you have an Ivy League degree, even if you have job experience, these stories abound every day. You can have all the same credentials I can have, the same credentials as Bill O'Reilly, and you still get the call back for the job, and I don't.
But you have the good job.
Oh, we're talking me.
Yeah, you just said you.
I have a good job. I am one individual. Oprah is one individual.
Right.
Bill Cosby is one individual.
Barack Obama is one individual. You all have good jobs.
But these numbers writ large, that number, that comparison doesn't hold up, and you well know it. That's why white privilege exists.
You know, when my friends in Levittown hear the word white privilege and that we in Levittown had privilege being raised there, they laugh. They openly laugh at that because it was such a hard scrabble existence, and the blacks who lived in Hempstead, a couple of miles away, they had a hard scrabble existence too. But there wasn't a lot of big difference back in the 50s and 60s between the two neighborhoods. But look, theoretically, I know what you're talking about.
But it's not theoretics, though. It's not theoretically, it's in actuality.
See,
politically, socially, economically, the numbers bear out the fact that if you happen to have less melanin in your skin, the chances are that you'll do better. And
you'll do better, but it isn't because of white privilege.
Because you're smarter?
No.
Because you work harder?
You just asked me. You want me to answer?
Tell me why.
It's a collapse of the black family. That's the reason.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this. Every major corporation in this country has outreach to minorities. They want minorities. Every college has outreach. They're in New York City here. You can go from preschool through your graduate degree and never pay a dime if you're a minority. And I will go back to the fact that it is about the disintegration of the African-American family and the not having supervision on the children that is holding black Americans back. Go.
I won't argue you on that point, but here's what
that's the big point.
Here's what I will argue you on. There are more white folk in poverty in this country than there are African Americans. The new poor in this country are the former middle class. These are not my numbers. These are not PBS numbers. When one out of two Americans, Census Bureau numbers, one out of two Americans is either in or near poverty, that ain't a black or brown problem. That's an American catastrophe.
It's an American problem, but there is, again, a reason why. The reason why there are more whites than blacks in poverty is because of the numbers. Blacks make up 13% of the population. But there is a commonality between black poverty and white poverty. And you know what it is? Lack of education. If you are a college graduate in this country, the unemployment rate is less than 4%.
I get a kick out of these guys. They're all skirting around the issue. And what's wrong with white privilege? It's just that the white upper class, the ruling class, does not want to trickle down. But of course the white race should have more, deserve more, work harder to get it and the whole bit. So this idea of apologizing for white superiority and white privilege is ridiculous. I'd spit in their eye and say, so what, nigga boy, get back to work. Of course, some of the things he says is true. That's right. Well, I see a New York City cop retired, opened fire on a father and son duo, killing the younger man, said the police, and he was arrested. Yeah, these trigger-happy cops and ex-cops are a problem. Well, I see a little Negro former state representative Weddington is released from prison over here in Ohio. Boy, there's a lot of shit goes on in Ohio. Former Columbus State Representative W. Carlton Weddington was released from prison yesterday, 10 months before the end of his 3-year prison sentence for bribery, election falsification, and ethics violation. Boy, they don't make a lot of noise about these kind of deals. Another story out of Ohio. Neo-Nazi deserves death, Cordray says. Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray yesterday urged the U.S. Supreme Court to clear the way for the execution of a self-styled neo-Nazi convicted in 1983 of murdering 3 people at Cleveland State University. Well, that's an interesting story, but boy, I'll tell you, when blacks over there in Ohio go on a death spree and kill a whole bunch of people, over and over and over again, we don't see these attorney generals standing up and saying, urging the U.S. Supreme Court to clear the way to execute these niggers. You never see that, do you? Boy, I'll tell you, they're pouring all kinds of gas on the fire in this election. But it's not race-baiting for whites. It's race-baiting and sucking up to the blacks. They're going crazy trying to get these stupid blacks off their ass to go down and vote. Let me play you a little sample of some of this out of North Carolina.
Hey, North Carolina.
In 2008, 2 Democrats, Kay Hagan and Barack Obama, won North Carolina thanks to over 70% of the state's black voters turning out.
We're counting on you to help make some history.
This time around, it's just Senator Hagan on the ballot. The challenges for her and for Democrats across the country in getting black voters back to the polls. Now, on the Election Minute.
Everybody in North Carolina...
In North Carolina, little expense has been spared. Democrats are touting a get-out-the-vote effort with 10,000 volunteers. There's also been a parade of visitors, many very popular in the black community.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Charlotte Saturday.
Meanwhile, some of the messaging from Hagan allies has been less than subtle. This flyer was reportedly distributed at an African-American church in Fayetteville. Notice the lynch mob in the background. And a radio ad got instant notice when it evoked Trayvon Martin to criticize the Republican nominee.
Tillis even led the effort to pass the type of stand your ground laws that caused the shooting death of Trayvon Martin.
But remember, white voters still make up 70% of North Carolina's electorate, and they only have a 25% approval rating of the president. As such, the Republican strategy is clear.
If you want to stop the Obama policies, you have to replace Kay Hagan.
For Senator Hagan, she emphasizes her moderate credentials, especially when speaking to a statewide audience.
I think North Carolinians want a common sense voice.
North Carolina, certainly one of the close races of the country for control of the U.S. Senate.
She's walked the tightrope between white and black voters better than most. Some Democrats in a similar position have even refused to say whether they voted for the president.
This election isn't about the president.
Senator Hagan has maintained a slight lead and a 6-to-1 cash-on-hand advantage. Despite all that, if North Carolina's black voters don't turn out on Tuesday, it could be an early end to Democrats' hopes of retaining the Senate.
Well, isn't that just peachy keen, man?
Your phone is smart. Your kids are smart.
Shut
your
up,
dog.
Nigger. So let me get this straight. If the country only has 13% black, which I say is a bunch of bullshit, but say they got 25%, okay? Now, the fact that far more white Republicans stay home from a lot of these elections wipes that out. So if these Republican leaders want to really beat them, they would appeal to the white working class, even the white racial class, instead of kissing the ass of these blacks that have the poorest voting record in the country. Now, these top leaders aren't idiots. They know that, but they're scared. They're afraid. Or somebody's way up top telling them what to do and what not to do. And in many cases, it might be a Jew. Well, I see that funny man, Eddie Murphy guy. You know, he hasn't made me, I haven't seen him make any movies lately. No. Well, he's got his girlfriend for 2 years. This beautiful blonde chick. Got a whole bunch of pictures here out of Hollywood of parading her up and down the street. And she's just happy as punch with that ugly nigger. Oh, boy. The day is coming. The day is coming. Well, let's have a little education time here, boys and girls. It's about that time of the week again. We're going to go back to our exiles from history, and we're going to continue with the heading of communism. This was written by David McCollum about 25 years ago. In a fascinating detailed article in the Journal of Psychohistory, fall 1978, psychohistorian Stanley Rothman provides a useful summary of Jewish involvement with communism throughout the Western world in, quote, group fantasies and Jewish radicalism. He writes, quote, in the interwar years, this role was probably most visible in the countries of Eastern Europe where Jews were prominent in Bela Kun's abortive attempt to set up a communist regime in Hungary, and where they came to constitute over 40% of the cadres of the Polish Communist Party, and probably comparable percentages elsewhere. In Hungary, immediately after the Communist Party's accession to power, the Politburo of the party contained only one non-Jew. It was jokingly suggested that this Goy had been admitted to the inner circles only because someone was needed to sign decrees on Saturdays. Quote, in Germany, the situation was rather different. Jews played a very important role in the revolutionary Spartacus movement of 1918 to 1919. However, radical Jewish intellectuals remained largely unaffiliated, serving as unattached, often bitter radical critics of the Weimar Republic. The Frankfurt School, which produced Adorno, Fromm, Marcuse, Horkheimer, and others, was almost entirely Jewish. In the United States, perhaps some 50% of the Communist Party was of Jewish background during the 30s. The Radical American Student Union was heavily Jewish. And just as importantly, the Soviet espionage apparatus in this country was pretty largely of Jewish background. In Western Europe, Jews continued to take an active radical role in France. During the 1968 upheavals, students of a Jewish background dominated the Trotskyite leadership cadres. Jews provided the critical mass for student left and the counterculture in the United States during the early and mid-60s. Studies indicate that in its initial phases, SDS leadership was about 60% Jewish. Rothman goes on to show how Jewish radicals even ran the show at Midwestern campuses. One Gentile SDS organizer at Madison, Wisconsin commented, quote, "I'm struck by the lack of Wisconsin-born people in the left and the massive preponderance of New York Jews. The situation at the University of Minnesota is similar. In the facilities, too, the radical factions were largely Jewish." In another article aimed at Cognoscenti, American Jewish Historical Quarterly, December 1976, Arthur Liebman shows in The Ties That Bind, quote, "The members and particularly the officers of the left organizations were predominantly Jewish. Andre Shifrin, president of the SLID in the 1956-1957, and himself of Jewish background, was very cognizant of the foreign element within SLID. For a while, all our national officers, myself included, were foreign-born." Whoa! Well, I did it again. I forgot to turn the phone off. And it's always a salesman or some jerk you haven't heard from in 20 years that wants to just talk. Oh, man. Others noted the frequent usage of Yiddish expressions among the members. Another indication of the large Jewish component was the care taken to ensure that regional and national conventions of these left non-sectarian groups would not coincide with important Jewish holidays. No such attention was paid to Christian holidays, and on one occasion, a Protestant minister was sharply critical of SLID for scheduling a meeting on Good Friday, unquote. Indeed, Liebman shows that Jews have regarded communism as an extension of Judaism for many years. The Jewish Daily Forward, a Yiddish socialist newspaper, to a large extent surpassed the rabbis and orthodoxy as the educator of the Jewish community in the United States. The more astute and sensitive Jewish socialists in the pre-World War I years sought opportunities to demonstrate that Judaism, as they defined and interpreted it, was quite compatible, if not supportive, of socialism. Socialism was presented to the Jewish masses as a secular version of Judaism. Thus, during a strike, the Law of Moses was cited in support of the strikers. The Socialist Party's Rand School was lyricized by the Forward at its founding in 1906 as the Socialist Yeshiva, where the rabbis and teachers of our movement were being prepared, unquote. In this curriculum, these schools emphasized the interrelatedness between Jewish and radical concerns. The progressive aspects of Judaism were stressed. For example, in the case of the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, the traditional blowing of the shofar was the clarion to rally for liberation of the Jewish people from oppressors. And of course, they always had oppressors. The shofar blowing for the laboring masses will drown out the trumpeting of the temporary ruling interests of the earth, unquote. See, it seems like when the Jews attack the ruling class, they're only attacking it to bring it down so they could take over and leave us white Aryan working class out in the cold. The accomplishments of these schools were summarized in an editorial in Jewish Life, a magazine with close ties to them, in the following manner. Quote, "The schools develop in the children a kinship with Jewish and non-Jewish laboring masses, and with the history and progressive culture and traditions of the Jewish people. The children acquire an elementary knowledge of Yiddish. They're taught to identify their interests with those of the Negro people and other oppressed groups. At this point, we could enter into a tedious cataloging of names and pseudonyms of communist leaders throughout the 20th century who happened to be Jewish. Certainly such a roll call would be useful for archival purposes, but it would undoubtedly be a boring and unnecessary chore for the reader. Such lists are already available in the British Samstat publication, mischievously titled Let My People Go, and in the American book Behind Communism. But our purpose is not to go over again ground which has already been firmly established. Even our two Jewish writers cited above implicitly acknowledge the aphorism that communism is, was, and probably always will be Jewish. Our aim is to explore behind the pages of history, to read between the lines, to analyze and ask why. Why are Jews radicals? Rothman writes, quote, Jerry Rubin ascribes his own radicalism to being Jewish and finds that the Cohn-Bendit shares the same feelings. It is clear, too, that his primary hostility is towards Christianity, telling Pat Boone that Christianity has murdered more people than any other ism in the history of the world. Well, that's probably true. Roger Kahn, writing about the Columbia conflict, keeps remembering how badly Jews were treated by the WASP establishment. And Paul Cohen is convinced, from his experiences at Chote, that the WASP are all anti-Semitic racists. Oh, I wish it were true. As Teitelbaum has shown, Jews anxious to deny their Jewishness, those who feel marginal, are more likely to perceive Christians as anti-Semitic than those who continue to identify as Jews. Rothman argues that the Jewish radicalism, as well as Zionism, stems from the historical marginal position of Jews in Christian societies and to the family structure and personality patterns derived from that marginality. Jews have developed a particular set of perceptions and underlying motivations which can be described as a group fantasy. It may well be that the Jews are marginal in Western society in terms of religion, culture, lifestyle, and so on, but they're certainly less marginal than, say, the Orientals, so one wonders why Orientals are not more radical than Jews. Rothman's subsidiary point is more interesting. He suggests that the Jews, perceiving themselves as being surrounded by a hostile, threatening host society, are too few in number to openly display hostility back. So instead, they channel their hostility and aggression towards their own families, hence the emasculating Jewish mother, and into occupations which allow for much indirect verbal aggression. But as Rothman admits, quote, good studies of Jewish personality traits are few in number for a variety of reasons, not the reason of which is, as Sanua points out, that scholars have tended to avoid the subject. No mention of why, of course. Rothman goes on, quote, it is arguable that European diaspora, and the ghetto experience encouraged among Jews the emergence of a particular family pattern, a pattern characterized by mothers who were protective and controlling, especially with their male children. It was not enough to teach such children to curb the direct expression of aggression against the Christian enemy, for under such circumstances, control might be lost in a crisis situation. Rather, aggression must be driven underground by appropriate child-rearing practices. Well, let's see here. That's the end of that chapter. How much time we got here? Well, we got some time. Close to the heart. the tefillin, or phylacteries, should be worn by every Jewish male after his bar mitzvah for morning prayers every weekday morning and during the afternoon service on the 9th of AV. Women are not supposed to wear tefillin, but there have been exceptional cases. For instance, a group of dedicated female Hebrew scholars in the Middle Ages are known to have worn the tefillin regularly. The tefillin was worn as a sign of dedication to God, and they are not worn on Sabbaths and festivals, as these days are themselves signs. Tefillin consists of two leather cubes, one worn on the arm, right-handed men wear them on the left, and vice versa, and it's known as the shel yad. The strap on the arm is wound round the hand to make the three Hebrew letters shin, daled, and yod, which signifies the Almighty. The significance of wearing the tefillin on the weak arm is that it should face the heart. The other box, known as the shel rosh, is worn on the head so that the Torah may dominate the head. Each box contains the four passages from the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy telling of the commandments written in black. Tefillin must be made by scribes and must be black. If the color fades, it must be restored. So there you go, probably more than you want to know. Many Jewish rituals are more akin to those of primitive peoples in the jungle than they are of customs of Westerners. Yet many Jewish figures who have made an impact upon Western history and thought have been profoundly influenced by Talmudic hocus-pocus. Karl Marx was tutored by the Talmudic sage Moses Hess. That was in the Jewish Chronicles, 29 August 1980. The institutionalization of this pattern was to have profound effects upon both Jewish males and Jewish females, effects which have been alluded to in part and are spelled out in some detail by the Bibring and Wolfenstein. The Jewish family became, in Bibring's terms, a kind of matriarchy, in which the husband was perceived by the children as more fearful, less capable, and weaker than the wife, who cared for and somewhat dominated him in crucial areas, whatever his professional or business achievements. He goes on, quote, Herbert Krugman, in a study of ex-communists, found that middle-class members of the party, mostly Jews, placed far more stress on the need for hardness than did working-class members of the party who were less likely to be Jewish. Krugman studied in the greatest depth this case reported by analysts of 10 men and 8 women. 5 of the men evidenced strong wishes to submit and some slight evidence of overt passive homosexuality during adolescence. The therapist described them as sadomasochistic, turning such aggression into themselves. Their self-images varied between extremes, from the worthlessness to superiority, and with many there is an attitude of martyrdom, a bittersweet anticipation of revenge. Many Jewish males then seem to have a character structure classified by Jules Nides as paranoid masochistic. The following represents a summary of Nides' formation.
One moment, please.
Well, let's go back to Nides' formulation on the Jews. Number one, identifies with the aggressor. Two, hostility is reactive and compensatory. Three, effective rage is accompanied by a sense of malicious triumph, and release is experienced as effect is discharge. Four, the motive for aggression is to hurt someone who seems unable to fight back, and the effect is often intimidation of the victims. Oh, yeah. paranoid masochistic. One identifies with the victim in the sense that he's being persecuted. Two, hostility is defensive against anticipated attack because of unconscious feeling of guilt. Three, effective rage is accompanied by self-righteousness and often leads to a mounting fury rather than relief. Four, the apparent motive for aggression is to avoid being hurt by counter-attacking an assumed aggressor. Mm-hmm. The effect is often to provoke punishment, gratification of a repressed wish, and a reality confirmation of preconceived persecution. Rothman cites several profound examples of this exclusively Jewish phenomenon. He quotes from an interview with a Jewish ex-weatherman who recalls the motivations of himself and his peers in the 60s. Quote, A lot of weathermen leadership was Jewish and had never been tough street kids, and I really believe that a tremendous amount of what they were doing was overcoming their own fears about their masculinity. Most of them had been intellectually aggressive, but all of a sudden they were trying to be tough street kids. I think there was a lot of self-hate going on, unquote. Rothman even draws on fictional, though highly accurate, caricatures, such as Philip Roth's highly personal Portnoy in Portnoy's Complaint. Portnoy, of course, is only a quasi-radical, but whatever he would like to think his real motives are, his tirade to the analyst makes it quite clear that his love for suffering humanity is far less important than his envy and hatred of the WASPs and his desire to literally screw the Goyim, despite the fact that he despises his parents for their anti-Goyish attitudes. As he puts it, quote, I was on the staff of the House subcommittee investigating the television quiz show scandals, perfect for the closet socialist like myself. You know, when I'm talking about socialism here, we're talking about Jewish socialism, not Aryan socialism. Commercial deceit on a national scale, exploitation of the innocent public, elaborate corporate chicanery. In short, good old capitalist greed. And then, of course, that extra bonus, Charles Van Doren, such a character, such brain, such breeding, that candor and schoolish boy charm. That WASP, wouldn't you say? And turns out that he's a fake. Well, what do you know about that, Gentile America? Super Goy, a Ganif, steals money. Goodness gracious me, almost as bad as Jews. You sanctimonious WASPs. Quote, yes, I was one happy Yiddle down there in Washington. A little stern gang of my own, busily exploding Charlie's honor and integrity while simultaneously becoming lover to the aristocratic Yankee beauty whose forebears arrived on these shores in the 17th century. The situation is not quite so simple, for as the quotation indicates, Portnoy also wants to become one of these strong, blonde Goyim who own America and whose brothers are the engaging, good-natured, confident, clean, swift, and powerful halfbacks for the college football teams. His unconscious hope is that he can somehow become a Goy by sleeping with the Shishkas, white women, white non-Jewish women. There's much truth in Rothman's analysis. Jewish bourgeois communism is not just a bunch of Jewish capitalists suddenly discovering a more profitable venture, state capitalism. It is also a symptom of the eternal Jewish neurosis, the envy of all things Goyish that in turn becomes hatred of all things Goyish. Portnoy's caricatures for us, the eternal Jew, he would like nothing better than to have blue blood flowing through his veins. And by sleeping with the Shishkas, white women, he hopes that some of her blonde aristocratic ways will rub off on him. But when nothing much seems to change and Portney stays pretty much the same little yiddle he started off with, then his envy turns to hate and his sleeping with becomes screwing. We are immediately reminded of Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, where he tells us that he raped white women in order to get his own back on Whitey. We also observe the extraordinary disproportion in interracial rapes, such as male-female and male-male, which are almost 100% black against white. Can it be that Marxism is no more than an expression of Jewish self-hate redirected against the rest of us? Sigmund Freud. Freud was born in Freiburg, Moravia, which is today part of the Czechoslovakia, but was all at the time within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. His father, Jacob Freud, who lived from 1815 to 1896, was a successful wool merchant. At the time of Sigmund's birth, Jacob was 40 years old, with two grown-up sons and even grandchildren. Sigmund's mother was his father's second wife, and she was 20 years his junior. In 1860, the Freud family moved from the provinces up to the capital city of Vienna.
We going uptown, baby.
There's the young Freud began to develop the almost inevitable Jewish characteristic, fear of anti-Semitism. He adopted as his boyhood heroes Hannibal, whom he imagined to be a Semitic hero who fought against the era's traditional anti-Semites, the Romans, and Oliver Cromwell, whom he identified with the emancipation movement. In passing, it may be noted that with some irony that both Sigmund Freud and Adolf Hitler lived in Vienna around the same time. It is open to speculation whether or not they had a subconscious influence on each other. Hitler maintains in Mein Kampf that he never entertained an anti-Semitic thought in his head until he encountered these people and experienced their behavior patterns when he moved to the big city. At that time, Vienna was a hotbed of pro- and anti-Semitic feelings. The Habsburg monarchy and city administration under Karl Luger were all alleged to be anti-Semitic. And of course, all the radical movements of the left, such as the Social Democrats under Victor Adler, were dominated by Jews. It was in this tense environment that Freud enrolled in the University of Vienna in 1873, where it took him 3 years longer than normal to complete his medical studies. He moved on to Vienna General Hospital, where he acted as assistant to several Austrian neuropathologists. From 1884 onwards, he began to experiment with cocaine, using it on himself and on his fiancée, Martha Bernays. He called cocaine, remember, this Bernays family, Edward Bernays, who really screwed things up in this country, and especially promoting the First World War, and cigarette smoking, and bacon and eggs. He called cocaine his magic carpet and thrust it on all and sundry, including his sisters, friends, patients, colleagues, everyone. He told his fiancée it made him a big, wild man, and it would make her strong and give her cheeks a red color. Later commentators would express doubts about this habit. Martin L. Gross, author of The Psychological Society, writes, quote, "No one has yet evaluated the hallucinatory effects of cocaine on Freud's mind during the formative years of psychoanalysis. Without cocaine, could Freud have created such improbable flights of human fancy?" Unquote. By 1886, cases of cocaine addiction were being reported from all over Austria. Freud's friend Ernst von Fleischl Marxow had become a despairing addict after Freud had prescribed cocaine as medicine for a painful hand tumor. There is no doubt that the addiction brought about his early death. Freud then left for Paris to study under the French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot. Charcot was interested in the study of hysteria, which at the time was thought to be an affliction caused by an irritation of the womb, hence its name. Charcot felt that hypnotism was the answer to such personality dysfunctions. The modern commentators on Freud's work, Henry Ellenberger, has recently shown in the discovery of the unconscious that many of Freud's original ideas were in fact lifted from his tutors and colleagues. That's normal. They like to steal other people's work. This idea of hypnotizing patients would appear to be one of them. Another of Freud's plagiarized ideas was that of his colleague Joseph Breuer. Breuer felt that the answer to female hysteria was catharsis. The patient would be healed by talking to her calmly and helping her talk through her hallucinations and fears. Freud and Breuer collaborated on a book, Studies in Hysteria, which was published in 1895, which described the treatment in detail. One of the most important cases described in the book was that of Anna O. Anna O, who later turned out to be Bertha Pappenheim, and who went on to become a prominent social worker and proponent of women's liberation in Austria. Miss Pappenheim suffered from sexual hallucinations, and it may well be that it was this particular case which led Freud to develop his next theory, an only semi-original one, of psychotherapy. Psychotherapy was a potpourri of techniques lifted from the previous colleagues, laced with heavy doses of sexual fixations, most of them of an exclusively Jewish nature. Originally, Freud would have his patient lie down on a couch and ask them to leading questions in order to discover the root cause of their anxieties. Later, he would allow them to have free flow of ideas without interruption from him. Soon, Freud began to figure that most of his patients' problems were sexual in nature. This discovery did not go over too well with the medical establishment in Vienna. The only one to take him seriously initially was one Wilhelm Fleiss, a Berlin nose and throat specialist. Fleiss had some rather peculiar ideas himself, including the notion that sexual dysfunction was caused by disturbances in the mucous membranes of the nose. Freud twice allowed Fleiss to operate on his nose for nasal infections, but it is not known whether or not either doctor had diagnosed a sexual disorder. There is some evidence that Freud and Fleiss had a homosexual relationship. Freud continued to be plagued by bad health, migraines, nightmares, heart trouble, and eventually mouth cancer. He began to interpret his dreams, and when he experienced one where two birdmen laid his mother on the bed, he figured that this was representing his boyhood desire to kill his father and have sex with his mother. Oh, man. The wacky world of Jews. Another analyst may have interpreted it as having too much cheese and pickles before going to bed. But Freud insisted that such dream symbolisms were typical and labeled the phenomenon the Oedipus complex, after the famous Greek fable. You know, I have a dream, it's weird, and sometimes I have it several times for a few days, and then it goes away, and that is, I'm somewhere traveling. Sometimes I have somebody with me, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I sort of recognize the area where I'm at, and sometimes I don't. But the key to the dream is really weird. I lose my car, and I can't find my car. And I anguish for quite a bit of time in my dream, searching vainly for my car, and I never find it. Now, if you guys can figure that one out, let me know. Well, let's see here. Eventually, Freud patched together his dream analysis into a full-fledged theory, which was published as an interpretation of dreams. His theory was that dreams are always wishful thinking. Well, that don't make sense. I don't wishful think about losing my car, especially when I'm a long way from home. Even though the wishes might be subconscious and might manifest themselves in the dream in quite a different symbol form. Most wishful thinking, he argued, was sexual in nature. I want to have sex with a car. No, I can't catch the car. In this book, which would later become Freud's best-known work, the author alluded to a dysfunction from which he himself suffered, a phenomenon he calls Rome neurosis. It seems that for many years, Freud had been unable to visit Rome, even though he had been in Italy many times. Somehow he just could not bring himself to go there. In his book, he described how he only dreamed of conquering Rome, just like his hero Hannibal had tried to do. He offered the following explanation. Quote, to my youthful mind, Hannibal and Rome symbolized the conflict between the tenacity of Jewry and the organization of the Catholic Church. Thus, the wish to go to Rome and become my dream life, a cloak and a symbol for a number of other passionate wishes. Their realization was to be pursued with all the persuasiveness and single-mindedness of a Carthaginian, unquote. In his startling, candid article, Group Fantasies and Jewish Radicalism, published in the fall of 1978, issues of the Journal of Psychohistory, Stanley Rothman suggests, quote, there is little question but that a good deal of the impetus for the discovery of psychoanalysis came from Freud's general hostility towards Christianity, especially Roman Catholicism. Boy, I tell you, the religion is really the bane of humanity. He argues that Freud's hatred and fear of Christianity prevented him from visiting Rome, and they only managed to overcome this fear after the triumphal publication of the Dream Book. Freud next turned his attention to human sexuality with the 1905 publication of Three Essays on the Theory of Sexuality. He argued that humans go through different stages of sexual development. First, the oral stage, where infants derive pleasure from suckling at the mother's breast. Next comes the anal stage, where pleasure focuses on bowel movements. That's typically Jewish. Third is the phallic stage, when the erogenous zone switches to the genitals. At the age of 5 or 6, children enter into the age of their Oedipus complex, when they lust for their mother and seek to destroy their father, the love rival. Freud's first diagnosis of this complex was with a 5-year-old boy in 1909. He felt that the boy was afraid of horses, penis symbols, because he really feared his father. He feared the horses would bite him and bite off his own little penis. Fear of castration by his father. Unfortunately, Freud could not come up with a female counterpart to this argument. In 1933, he wrote what I've had to say about femininity doesn't always sound friendly. It is incomplete. If you want to know more, look at your own experience in life, unquote. The first years of the 20th century brought followers into Freud's sphere of influence. Although mostly Jewish, there were one or two Gentiles, such as C.J. Jung, who became involved with the psychoanalytic movement and attended the first international congress at Salzburg in April 1908. Jung accompanied Freud on a speaking tour of America in the following year, and soon the Freudian movement became international. But within a couple of years, there were many splits in the movement, leading to Jung and his setting up his own school of analytic theory, according to one commentator. Quote, it is sometimes said that these splits were caused by Freud's tyrannical and dogmatic personality, but as Freud told his biographer Ernest Jones, it is not my personality, but my ideas about sexuality and the unconscious they don't like. Freud had originally brought Jung into the movement as a kind of token goy. Freud told his colleague Carl Abraham that too many of us are Jews. I don't want psychoanalysis to become a Jewish national affair. Jung may originally have had a homosexual crush on Freud. He wrote Freud, quote, "My veneration for you is something like a religious crush, though it does not really bother me. I still feel it is distinguishing and ridiculous because of its undeniable erotic undertone. This abominable feeling comes from the fact that as a boy I was a victim of a sexual assault by a man I once worshipped." Well, that's enough for today. You know, this sort of reminds me of Goebbels' strange attraction for Adolf Hitler. It was more than just subservient or friendship. And if you read what Goebbels says in the presence of Hitler, I suspect that there was at least a homosexual desire there. Whether it was ever acted upon or played out, I have no idea. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Saturn's Day, and we'll have a Sling Blade show or something like that tomorrow. And in the meantime, go out and grab some nigger tonight and say boo. Go grab a nigger and say boo. He gonna look at you like you crazy, man. Get away from me, white boy. God damn. Are you some kind of a spook? Oh, you tell him no, you're the spook, nigger. Okay. 14.5 and shut your pie hole, baby. Yeah.